or politics to get in the way of my duty. The crimes committed by Detective Harney strike at the heart of the problems in this city. When a sworn police officer not only breaches the trust of our citizens, but also kills to cover up that breach, I can think of no greater crime. I have vowed to stop this kind of corruption.
Why don't you vow to stop your mouth from running? Patty says to the screen.
For this reason, I will be personally prosecuting the case against Detective William Harney, says Margaret Olson.
Her words zap through my family room, a quick flash of lightning. And then there's nothing but silence for a palpable beat, even from the TV, as though she were talking directly to me and wanted the words to sink in.
I'm coming for you, Harney. You're mine.
William, Patty sneers, like that's the most intriguing part of what she just heard. Who the hell ever called you William? The press has taken to using my formal name, too. Even Kim Beans, whose career has rebounded nicely since the night of the sex club raid, who now has a spot as a crime reporter on the local NBC station, whom I've known for several years and has always called me Billy, now refers to me as Detective William Harney. Sometimes I prefer it that way, as if it's happening to someone else, not me.
William Harney? No, I'm Billy. That must be another guy who's charged with killing four people and facing life in prison.
Mom called me William, I say, when she was pissed. At you? Mom was never pissed at you. You were her little angel.
It was supposed to come out as a compliment, a supportive boost, but her comment turned sideways at the end.
Patty always thought I spent my life gliding along a smooth paved road as if my feet barely touched the ground, while she struggled to traverse a path of potholes and sharp curves. I never really figured it. We had the same life. We did the same stuff.
That's not a good development, says my father, just walking into my family room, leaning against the wall. Leave it to Pop to shoot straight, never to mince words.
Patty waves him off.
What does Margaret fucking Olson know from trying cases? She's a politician. She's not a trial lawyer.
Pop doesn't bother arguing. Quibbling with Patty can be exhausting. When she gets an idea in her head, she won't let go. The more unreasonable her position, the tighter she clings to it. And on one level, she's right. Margaret Olson isn't some veteran trial lawyer. She was an alderwoman who was elected the county's top prosecutor. She's no Clarence Darrow, but that's not Pop's point. His point is that if she's putting herself out there front and center, she can't lose the case. She can't. She'll be putting her entire candidacy for mayor on the line. If she loses my case, she'll look like an amateur, not the trusted corruption buster who will save this city.
Pop casts a look in Patty's direction, but can't summon any anger or frustration. All of us are pretty beaten down. It's been a rough 7 weeks since I was arrested and charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder. I was released on $1 million bond, which was the only good news because a lot of murder suspects are denied any bond at all. The best thing I had going for me, ironically, was my physical condition. The fact that I was still in recovery from a gunshot wound to the head. The county lockup ain't exactly the Mayo Clinic, and one of my doctors told the judge that I still needed weekly therapy. Anyway, Pop put up his house for bond and got me out. For the first couple of weeks afterward, I was hunkered down in my house or his, reporters waiting to pounce at any sight of me. Getting the mail every day was an exercise in stealth and misdirection. Now, nearly 2 months since my arrest, things have died down a bit. They're on to their next set of stories. Another weekend of double-digit homicides in the city. The city's pension crisis threatening to strangle the government. And God knows, the mayoral race is a daily headline. One candidate made a stupid comment, another candidate stepped in a pile of doo-doo. But they know that my trial isn't far away. Just a few short weeks. And soon they'll have the chance to gorge on the feast once more.
How's it going with the shrink? Pop asks me.
I shrug. We've tried everything. No luck so far. Dr. Jill Jagoda and I have tried everything that could pop something loose, that might poke a hole in the wall that is blocking my memory. We've spent entire sessions breaking down my relationship with my father and mother and sister and brothers. an entire session about Kate, multiple sessions dealing with Amy. We even tried hypnosis. When it was over, when I came out of it, the look on Dr. Jill's face was blank. She just shook her head briefly. She still thinks my emotions are repressing my memory. If that's true, then I must really, really not want to know what I did. Pop mumbles something to himself as he leaves the room. Once he's gone, Patty touches my leg. "Hey," she whispers. It feels like we're kids again, whispering behind our parents' backs, exchanging knowing glances and half-comments, finishing each other's sentences. Twin stuff. The screen cuts away from Margaret Olsen. The anchor is talking about a storm coming our way. I turn to Patty. "Maybe it's better you don't remember," she says.
"How so?"
"Well, who's to say your memory didn't come back?" she asks. I don't know what she means. And then I do. She makes a face, like she wants me to try on the idea, wear it around a little and see if it fits before saying no. Nobody can read your mind. If you say you remember, you remember. I shift on the couch and face her. And I suppose what I'm going to remember is that I didn't kill anybody? She runs her hand over the pillow behind me. Doesn't make eye contact, but keeps her eyebrows lifted, wanting me to consider it. "It might be better than the truth," she says. 64. I sit forward in the leather seat of Dr. Jill Jagoda's SUV, eyes outside scanning the streets. Daytime pedestrians, teenagers, moms with kids, dog walkers, some people getting a start on happy hour, soaking everything in, concentrating, eyes narrowed, focusing on everything and nothing at the same time. "Don't press," says Dr. Jill. "Make it come to you." This is the neighborhood where Amy Lentini lived, though I only know that because people have told me. I don't remember ever going to her apartment. Don't even remember the building. Amy, looming like a specter, her image so thin it's transparent, vanishing when I reach for it. Did we fall in love? Did we have sex? It feels like the answer to both of those questions is yes. But those last 2 weeks before the shooting are still a black void. I know that I was found naked in bed with Amy when I was shot, so there's no denying that we were together. But that's nothing more to me than something I don't really know, something I have to take the word of other people for. There's an ozone layer, but I can't touch it or smell it. There are other galaxies out there, but I can't see them. Amy and I were lovers, but I don't remember it. But those flashes keep returning, that longing, that deep sense of loss and ache. That much I can feel. It's like a mysterious illness, some amorphous pain for which doctors cannot find a source. "I want to ask you something," Dr. Jill says.
"Shoot."
"Why are you demanding a speedy trial? I mean, some defendants delay their trials for months or years. You could do that. You're out on bond. It's not like you're in a hurry."
"You sound like my lawyer. My attorney has argued constantly that we should delay this trial, wait until Margaret Olsen is elected mayor, let the media buzz die down, and give me time to regain my memory."
"It makes sense. I know it. But I can't live like this. I'm out on bond, but I'm trapped, locked behind bars I can't see, full of questions I can't answer. It's worse than pure terror. Pure terror is something I've experienced, breaking through a door, expecting someone on the other side with a shotgun, racing through an alley, chasing an armed suspect, knowing you're about to corner him and that it will come down to you or him, looking into the eyes of a suspect you know has killed with premeditation, the suspect knowing that you know, the sides of his mouth curving upward, those eyes boring into you, telling you, yeah, I'm a killer. I have taken life, and it doesn't mean a damn thing to me. That I can handle. Not this. Not the constant uncertainty. The ever-present shadow. The grief gurgling through my stomach. The lingering suspicion that I did something truly bad and just can't, won't, allow myself to remember it. The hope that I'm wrong, that there is another explanation. The fear that I'm reaching frantically for an answer I will not like, that I'm trying to break down a wall, but that when I do, A scalding fire will engulf me. There. Dr. Jagoda curbs Alexis and nods her head. I look around me. Where? That condo building right there. The awning. I look at the building. This is where Amy lived. This is where Amy and Kate were murdered. Nothing. The black void. Just another building to me. One of 1,000 condominium buildings in our city. I stare at the awning, up at the windows overlooking us, trying to will the building to speak to me. You walked through this door. You went up this elevator. You walked down this hall. You entered this apartment. I've seen plenty of photos of the interior of Amy's apartment. There was the crime scene. But it looked like they all do. The kitchenette, the single bedroom, the well-kept living room. You went into this apartment, you and Amy. Amy and I what? I don't remember even being in the apartment. Easy, says Dr. Jill. Don't press. I shake my head. Let's go. Why don't we walk around? It's a nice, I want to leave. Billy, this is about all we have left. We've talked about feelings and emotions and your childhood and your relationships. We've talked about your daughter and your wife and your hopes and fears. Believe me, Doc, I know. Okay. So you need to use your other senses. Your mind is struggling. You need to touch and smell and hear. You need to put yourself back in this place. You need to try to reconstruct the events. It's our last chance to unlock the door. Let's leave, I say. She pauses. I stare at the awning until it seems as if it's moving, waving at me, taunting me. It's okay to be afraid. I turn to her. I don't need a shrink to tell me it's okay to be afraid. I get that part. Afraid is about the only emotion I have anymore. I give up. Okay? I throw up my hands. I fucking surrender! No. We have 4 weeks until your trial. I'm not letting you give up. You're not letting me? This is your choice all of a sudden? Her eyebrows move together. Without her horn-rimmed glasses, which she took off while driving, she seems younger, more innocent. I don't think you killed anybody, she says. Then I hope you're on the jury. She doesn't think that's funny. Let's recreate it, she says. It's all we have left. How far do we take it? Should I shoot you? Are you going to shoot me? It's tempting, the way you're behaving. I look back at the building, at the awning, up at the windows. It could possibly work. A reenactment. She seems to think so, and she's the expert. But I remember what Patty said to me. Maybe it's better you don't remember. Who's to say your memory didn't come back? Nobody can read your mind. If you say you remember, you remember. Maybe she's right. Maybe my only chance is to say whatever I have to say to save my ass. Make something up, something good. I can do that, right? Sure I can. I'm the best liar I know. It might be better than the truth. Thank you for everything, I say to Dr. Jill. But I'll take it from here. 65. I walk the streets, my stride improving every day, less of a limp, my stamina increasing too. The weekly therapy and my daily walks have helped. It feels good out here, the feel of late summer and early autumn, a crispness in the air as darkness begins its slow creep. Fuck my memory. It feels liberating to be freed from that locked room. I don't need to remember what happened to win my case. I just need a convincing story. By the time I hit Southport, north of Addison, darkness has settled in comfortably. The crowd up here isn't as thick as it is downtown, but I find myself in a steady stream of people. I don't do much other than walk and just exist. Just existing is a gift, I realize. I easily could have died from that gunshot wound. In fact, I was clinically dead for several minutes. So anything after that experience is just gravy, right? That's what I tell myself. That I'm lucky I'm still breathing, even if one day soon I may find myself living and breathing and existing in the Stateville Penitentiary. I glance over at a storefront and do a double take. Sure, absolutely certain, for just that moment, that I saw Amy staring back at me. Instead, it's just a mannequin with short jet black hair wearing a designer suit. That happens to me sometimes. Little triggers like that. I'm not seeing ghosts. It's not time for seances or exorcisms. But on occasion, I will look this way or that and swear that I saw her. And it's not the only thing I feel at this moment. I also feel something behind me. A shift in the pressure. Like some movement behind me ceased at just the time I did. I whip my head around. Nothing but a jumble of people moving in my direction. Nobody dropping back, ducking down, averting his eyes. Nobody following me. Still, it sweeps through me like a chill. So tired of looking over my shoulder. So sick of playing defense, clawing for my memory and feeling helpless. Time to stop playing defense and start playing offense. I hail a cab and head north. The hole in the wall. I haven't been there for ages. Once upon a time, it was the first instinct. You were thirsty and had an hour to kill, you went to the hole. I get out of the cab, the sound of the train passing overhead on the brown line, raining down some rust. I reach for the door of the bar and pause. Then I open it. The place dies down when I walk in. Something out of a movie, the music stopping, conversations breaking to a halt in mid-sentence, like the abrupt screech of the needle lifting off a turntable. All eyes on me. None friendly. Nearly 100 faces I recognize. People I've known and worked with on the job. At the bar, Patty has a bottle of beer hoisted to her lips, frozen in midair as she stares at me. "This is a bar for cops!" someone shouts. "Not cop killers!" My fists in balls. My jaw set. I cut an angle toward the corner that I once owned, where people once watched and laughed, where people once chanted my name. I step up on the stage and grab the microphone, click it on, pat it for good measure. "We don't want to hear your jokes," someone yells. "This isn't a joke. I didn't kill any cops," I say into the mic. "I didn't kill anybody." "What happened to I don't remember anything?" someone shouts. I scan the room again, my heart pounding, my stomach doing gymnastics. "Well, I remember now," I say. "I remember. And I didn't do it." I drop the mic, sending a booming clang across the room and step off the stage. "Hey!" I turn on my way out. It's Wisniewski's chubby face coming my way. "You're not welcome here. You know what you did, and we know what you did." "And I know what you did," I say, doubling down on my lie. I pivot and move toward him. He's ready for me, hands raised. On a good day, I might have a better response, but I'm still moving slowly, and before I can bat them away, Wisniewski's fingers wrap around my throat. He pushes me backwards against the table, my back arched, my eyes up at the ceiling. My head fills with a rush of anger and desperation as the crowd comes alive with a roar, as the Wiz's chubby face peers into mine, as I struggle to loosen his grip. But I can't. I just, bam! The table over which I'm bent backwards rocks violently, glass shattering. The Wiz releases me and steps back. For a moment, I don't know what happened. It was like an earthquake of great magnitude, but limited to the small table. Patty, holding a baseball bat she must have grabbed behind the bar, letting it rest against her shoulder, but elbow out like she's ready to take a swing. Her mouth set evenly, like she's cool as ice, but her eyes on fire. "You like picking on people with medical conditions?" she says to the Wiz, loud enough for everyone to hear. "Want to try someone who didn't take a bullet to the brain?" Wisniewski, chest heaving, face tomato red, glares at Patty. "Hey, bitch on wheels! You really want to bring a baseball bat to a gunfight?" Patty takes the bat in both hands, holding it horizontally, and tosses it at Wisniewski's chest. He puts out his hands defensively, not trying to catch it, so it hits his palms and clangs to the floor at our feet. Before I know it, Patty has drawn a gun and has it within an inch of Wisniewski's nose, her legs spread in the pose. "Who needs a bat?" she says. Like she doesn't have a care in the world. Like it wouldn't bother her in the slightest if she pulled the trigger. The crowd isn't sure how to react. A crowd of cops, most of them off duty, most of them wearing their pieces. Most retreat or crouch. Some reach for their waists. This could go a lot of different ways. Some of them bad.
The fuck you doing? Come on, Patty,
Wisniewski says, not really believing she'll use it. But still, she's an itchy trigger finger away from splattering his brains on the ceiling. It does something to a fella's attitude.
We done?
She says.
Fuck yes, we're done, we're done.
Then apologize to my brother.
I apologize.
She lowers the gun and says, come on. It's a moment before I realize she's saying it to me. We walk out of the hole, now stunned into silence. What was that about? I remember now, she asks me as we beat a path from the bar.
What was that about drawing your weapon?
You first. Like you said before, who's to say I don't remember, I say.
Fuck trying to regain my memory. I'll just remember whatever I decide I remember.
Good. Great, she says. Doesn't mean you had to announce it to a room full of cops. Was that smart? Maybe not, I think to myself as I raise my hand for a cab. Maybe so. 66. I look out my bedroom window, watching a man and woman, young lovers, staggering home from a night of partying, the woman holding her heels in her hand, the man singing some pop song in a falsetto voice, trying to sound awful, the cool air filled with their laughter. I take a swig from my beer, but it tastes wrong. Bitter, rancid. Booze has tasted that way since the shooting, since I recovered from the coma. Food has too, as though the damage to my brain screwed up the connections to my taste buds, rearranged them while I slept. I'm supposed to eat 4 meals a day to get my weight back, but I can hardly stomach 3 squares. Some days the only things I eat are plain pieces of bread and water. Maybe in some weird way I'm readying myself for prison, for the tasteless paste they will slop on my plate every day. I look at the handgun on the bedside table. I won't deny that it's crossed my mind at my darkest moments, when my memory loss drove me to the precipice, when I wanted to tear my hair out and peel off my skin and scream until I had no voice, when I was convinced that I must have committed murder, that the evidence didn't add up any other way, and that I will spend the rest of my life in a living hell of prison. I thought about tasting the steel on my tongue, the muzzle so deep in my mouth that I gag, squeezing my eyes shut and willing my thumb to pull the trigger. I thought about it, but I'm too stubborn to do it. The Irish don't commit suicide. We just let ourselves be miserable forever. I have a story. It's not what I remember, and it may or may not be true, but it's a story. Kate walked in on Amy and me having sex, and opened fire in a jealous rage. That's what everybody thought at first, before the test results came back, before they had completed their investigation, before they discovered that my gun, not Kate's, was used to kill Amy, before they recovered the text messages from Kate's missing phone. But it's the best story I can think up. It matches the crime scene to some extent, and it's pretty straightforward. A jealous rage. A woman scorned who happens to be heavily armed at the time of said scorn doesn't require me to prove a number of different facts. Even if jurors might not do it themselves, they can understand the sting of betrayal and the temptation to act on it, to kill the person who stole your lover from your arms and shoot the cheating bastard too. It's been the stuff of movies, of songs, of novels for a reason. Everyone can relate to it on some level. Either that, or I put on no defense at all, a sure loser. Or I take the witness stand and sit there like a dumbass, shrug at Margaret Olsen's questions and simply say, good question, wish I knew. Don't remember. Can't argue with you there. Boy, I agree, that sure looks bad. But there might be an innocent explanation if I could just fucking remember. Enough. Enough of that crap. I look once more at the log of those text messages, the ones that Wisniewski showed me with such delight, the ones Kate sent as she stood outside Amy's apartment door only minutes before everything happened. Open the door, she was texting me. Need to talk to you. Why would I do that? I said in response, as if Kate had picked a terrible time for a chat. And Kate's answer, those words, those simple words in black and white on the page I hold in my hand, but not black and white, full of fire and fury, rising off the piece of paper and floating in front of me, dancing and taunting me. Because she knows, you idiot. She knows about you, and so do I. I've tried to decipher this message for the 7.5 weeks since I was charged with murder. I've tried to remember, and I've tried to think logically. But the two things are sewn together. I can't fit the pieces together when I don't have the pieces, when I can't remember what happened. The more I call out from my memory, begging, pleading for it to return, the farther it burrows into the shadows. I will have to learn to live with it, like a patient with a spinal injury who has to accept that he'll never walk again. I have to accept that I'll never remember, that I'll never really know, that it will lie buried inside me until the day I die. So I'll be a good soldier. I'll learn to cope with it. But still, I will wonder. Every hour of every day of every year, I will wonder. What did Amy know about me? What could I have done that was so bad? The past. 67. Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? I do. Or at least, that's what I told the clerk before I took my seat on the witness stand. I straightened my tie. I looked over the courtroom. So crowded with reporters and spectators that it felt like the walls would bend outward. The defense table was thick with lawyers, while their clients, including Mayor Francis Delaney and Archbishop Michael Xavier Phelan and a cast of other VIPs, sat behind them in the front row. The first defense lawyer, the mayor's lawyer, stood and buttoned his jacket. This wasn't the trial itself. This was the hearing, where the defense would try to convince the judge that I lacked probable cause to enter the brownstone. If they won, the arrests were invalid, and all these guys would walk free. This was their only shot. After all, we caught these defendants in various states of undress with young women. They had no plausible defense at trial. Nobody was going to believe that they snuck into a discreet high-society sex club to play parcheesi with scantily clad women. Their only hope was to wrap themselves in the Bill of Rights, the Fourth Amendment. Their only hope was to tear me to shreds. Amy's eyes were on me, but I looked away when I saw her. It was all business now, so it wasn't the time for me to discuss other matters. Other matters such as the glossy, full-color 8x10 photograph of Amy walking up the steps to the brownstone. The photograph that someone put into a plain envelope and propped against my door last night. The photo that I brought with me today that was too big to stick in my pocket, so I put it in my briefcase next to the prosecution table. It was hidden, tucked away inside a flap, and it felt radioactive, sending out signals to me that something was not what it seemed. But no time for that now. Now was all business. Detective, the mayor's lawyer, Shaw de Kramer, once served under the first President Bush as his attorney general. He had since joined some powerhouse law firm, Read 'em and Weep, or maybe it was Woulda, Coulda, and Shoulda, and handled cases from coast to coast, usually high-stakes trials involving celebrities and politicians. You didn't have a warrant when you entered the brownstone, did you? He asked.
That's correct.
Could you... De Kramer waved a hand, strolled a bit in front of the defense table. Could you describe the brownstone?
I did my best. An old place, freestanding, sandstone and dark wood, arched entry, 3 stories.
How many exits and entrances? He asked.
1 entrance in the front, another in the back.
Anything else? Secret tunnels? Any kind of elaborate escape routes?
I shrugged. Not that I knew of, but you never know.
But the point is, you didn't know. At the time of the raid, you didn't have any reason to believe there was some clever way that the people in the brownstone could escape or anything.
That's correct.
In fact, Detective, you'd never set foot in that brownstone, had you? Before the raid, I mean.
His point was fairly obvious if you understood the Fourth Amendment, which I pretty much did as a cop. Amy had hammered it into me during trial prep. If you don't have a warrant when you enter, you better have a good reason.
The most common reason is that you're aware of criminal conduct. You saw drugs or weapons, for example, through a window. And you fear that if you don't go in immediately, if you take the time to go before a judge and secure a warrant, the offenders will have time to destroy the incriminating evidence, if not escape altogether.
De Kramer is trying to demonstrate that I didn't have any such concern the night of the raid.
I had never set foot in that brownstone, I said.
In fact, he said, wagging a finger, as though the thought had just occurred to him, the reason you were there that night in the first place had nothing whatsoever to do with prostitution, did it?
No, it did not. I explained the initial reason for the stakeout, that I was investigating a murder, that I had a suspect, that I wanted to catch him in the act of sleeping with a prostitute so I'd have some leverage over him and get him to answer some questions about the murder.
Sounds like a smart plan, De Kramer said.
When a lawyer pays you a compliment, look up. There's probably a guillotine poised to drop down on your neck.
Thank you, I said. So you had this murder suspect, and you had already followed him to this brownstone the previous week, and your plan was to catch him in a compromising position, shall we say?
That's correct.
And yet, having had this plan in your head for a week, you did not ask a judge for a warrant.
I did not.
You didn't ask the state's attorney's office to help you apply for a warrant.
I did not.
And that's because you weren't worried about making a case against this guy for prostitution. You were concerned about bigger stuff. A murder.
Correct.
De Kramer nodded, glanced down at his feet, at his polished Ferragamo shoes. There was no jury for this hearing. If this case went to trial and he had 12 in the box, he wouldn't be wearing $1,000 shoes. He'd try to dress like a man of the people. If you had been trying to put a case on this suspect for prostitution, if that had been your plan all along, you'd have applied for a warrant, right? Objection?
Amy Lentini popped halfway up from her chair. She knew the question was proper, but she was trying to disrupt his flow and also signal to me, if I didn't already know, that the water was getting choppy.
I might have, I said, after the judge overruled the objection. But you're making this sound like some elaborate advance plan. It wasn't. I'd been looking for a chance to confront this suspect about the murder. I saw this as an opportunity, and I took it. I asked a few of my fellow detectives to ride along for support. That's all.
De Kramer nodded, as though he expected my answer. He neither expected it nor liked it, but he'd never admit to either one. These guys were as smooth as butter.
Fair enough, he conceded. Let's talk about how you knew this was a house of prostitution. 68. Let me see if I have this straight, said Shaw to Kramer. The week before, you trailed the suspect to the brownstone. You saw him go in. You saw him leave an hour later.
Yes.
You stayed and watched the brownstone.
Yes.
You saw several attractive young women leave, women dressed provocatively.
Yes.
You saw nobody engaging in sexual intercourse.
No.
Not a single person.
I think I just answered that question. I didn't have x-ray vision. No, I was outside. That was good enough for the lawyer.
Amy Lentini flipped a pencil in her hand. Then you sat on, as you put it, you sat on the brownstone a couple of times over the next week.
Yes, correct. Twice that week before the raid, I parked across the street and conducted surveillance.
You saw the same types of things. Older men walking in. Young, provocatively dressed women walking in.
Right.
You didn't see anyone having sex?
Obviously not.
Or exchanging money?
No.
You didn't see which floors these people went to, did you? I mean, this was a three-story building.
No, I didn't. But I saw an armed doorman greet each of them. The women he just let in like he knew them. The men, he checked their names on a clipboard. I gathered from that, the way the men kept their heads down, acted like they didn't want to be seen, and basically had to sign in to get inside the place, that they weren't just making casual social calls.
But you never actually saw what any of these people were doing inside.
Men were parading in and out of there, Mr. De Kramer. The women came and stayed all night. Most of the men stayed for 1 hour, like clockwork, and some stayed for 2 hours. Then they left, acting just as suspiciously when they walked out as they did when they walked in. Was this a secret meeting of the Freemasons? Was it a Tupperware party? Maybe. but it sure seemed like a house of prostitution to me.
It seemed like one.
I turned, surprised to see that the judge was addressing me. The judge, with sharply combed black hair and a thick mustache, a guy named Walter McCabe, who'd been on the bench for more than 20 years. The judge is allowed to ask questions. The judge can do whatever he wants. This is his tiny fiefdom. But it's uncommon for a judge to interject himself into the questioning like this. It isn't a good sign.
It seemed like one, he said again, looking down on me. Based on the pattern of movement of the men, in and out by the hour?
And based on the way they behaved, and the young women. The judge didn't look convinced. Had he ever been a cop? Had he ever had to play a hunch? And did anyone care, by the way, that everything my gut had told me ended up being 100% spot-on correct? Judge McCabe said,
Detective, at any time before the night of the raid when you were staking out the brownstone, or on the night of the raid itself, at any point in time did you witness a crime in progress?
Every time I saw a man enter that brownstone, I witnessed a crime in progress.
But you know what I mean, Detective. It's not a crime to walk into a building.
It is if the building is a house of prostitution.
But you didn't know it was a house of prostitution. It seemed like one, you said.
But
did you see sex? Or money change hands? Did you ever see one of the young women with one of the men? Did you see them so much as touch hands or wave hello to one another? Do you even know if they were on the same floor of the brownstone together?
No, Judge. And if it had been just one guy walking in, or even a handful, I wouldn't have thought anything of it. But it was a steady stream, and the guard at the door, he was very careful about discretion. He made sure nobody was entering if someone was leaving. He would look out, make sure the coast was clear, and then someone would hustle out. There was nothing about this that looked normal.
Maybe not normal, he said. But criminal?
That was my judgment, yes. And I didn't have time for a warrant. By the time I could find a judge to get her to sign off, these clients would have left. There wasn't time. This is one of the crimes where you have to catch them in the act or you have no case. I had to move right away. The judge sat back in his seat, looking unsatisfied. For crying out loud, I thought to myself. Talk about second-guessing police work. Everything about the way that place operated smelled like an upscale house of prostitution, and I was right. It was. Didn't that count for anything? But here we were, in a pristine courtroom with walnut trim and shiny floors, listening to a guy in a robe who'd never spent a day on the street, and a lawyer dressed in an outfit that I couldn't afford on 2 months' salary, who'd never spent a real day in the shit either, acting like they knew better than me. The hearing wasn't over, not technically. Amy hadn't even had her chance to question me yet. But I could see it on the judge's face. He wasn't convinced. He thought I lacked probable cause. He was going to invalidate my search. He was going to toss this case. And my career along with it. 69. Lieutenant Mike Goldberger closed the door gently behind him before turning to address me and Kate, who would testify tomorrow. We were in a witness interview room on the same floor as the courtroom where I had just had my head handed to me. I stood and stretched. I'd been sitting all day. 7 hours of questioning from 6 defense lawyers, then Amy grilling me on every detail. Nothing seemed to make a difference. From the moment the judge addressed his questions to me, it was clear that he didn't like our case. Goldie said,
Okay, so that didn't go so well.
Which was like saying the Titanic's maiden voyage had some rough patches. It was a righteous search, I said.
Hell, I know that, Goldie said. But the judge isn't with us, that's obvious.
I shook my head. Some clown in a robe who hasn't
spent a day on the job, I know, Goldie grumbled. But we're past crying in our Cheerios. Time to fix this.
I looked up at him. Goldie didn't say things casually. Goldie pointed at Kate.
Detective Fenton, you guys staked out the brownstone 2 nights before the raid. When the stakeout ended, Billy went home. What did you do?
Kate said, without missing a beat. I left, too, but then I drove back to the brownstone. I spun around to face Kate.
Huh?
Kate kept her eyes forward on Goldie, avoiding my stare.
I drove back to the brownstone. I waited for the girls to leave. I followed two of them home.
First I'd heard of this.
Because it never happened.
And what happened next?
Goldie asked as though he were a prosecutor in court, as though he already knew the answer. Because he did know the answer. This wasn't the first time he was hearing it. The girls went home to their apartment on the second floor, said Kate. I walked up to their building and looked at the buzzer assigned to the second floor. There were two names next to it, Sanchez and Daniels.
Bullshit, I said. This is bullshit.
There was a postcard lying on the walkway next to the mail slot, Kate continued. An advertisement. A sale at Macy's or something, but it had a name on it. Erica Daniels.
So you had one woman's full name and a partial for the second, said Goldie. What happened next? Oh, for fuck's sake, I said. Hell, even I can finish this story, I looked at Kate. You went to the station and did a criminal background check. It turned out Erica Daniels had a prior for prostitution. And you did a search on Sanchez and found the same thing. Their mugshots looked like the girls you followed. And suddenly, oh my God, wouldn't you know, we knew that at least two of the women who spent the evening in that brownstone were hookers. I threw up my hands. Hallelujah! We have probable cause.
Goldie leaned against the wall.
Couldn't have said it better, actually.
Yeah, except for the minor detail that none of it actually happened. Kate didn't follow those women to their apartment. My arms came down by my sides. I mean, guys, what are we talking about? I turned to Kate again. Did Goldie talk you into this? I mean, I know he wants to protect us, but there's a... Who said it was Goldie's idea? She replied, as if she were insulted that I'd attribute perjury to him and not her. Kate stood up, face to face with me. If we lose this case, it's all over, she said. The mayor stays in office, right? Sure he does. He goes free. And his best buddy, the superintendent he appointed, Tristan Driscoll, he stays on the job too.
Goldie said, how long until the soup finds an excuse to run you off the force? Or worse yet, he assigns you to traffic duty the rest of your career. If this case goes south, that's your future, pal.
I'll take my chances, I said. Yeah, well, I won't take my chances. Kate shoved me. This isn't just about you, partner. My career goes down the tubes, too. I don't get a say in this? I let out air. Katie, I said. Oh, now it's Katie. She made quotation marks with her fingers. I looked at Goldie. When did this all come together? This little story of yours? He said,
you mean this little story that will save the careers of not one, but two police officers who are among the finest cops I've ever known? This little story that puts the bad guys where they belong? That little story?
I deflated. Goldie's heart was always in the right place. He'd stand in front of a train for me. From his perspective, this was just a little gloss on the truth, a harmless twist to prevent a miscarriage of justice. And more important, to protect me. Always looking out for me.
Kate, said Goldie, give us a minute, would you?
That seemed like a fine idea to her. She grabbed her bag and walked out in a huff, barely glancing in my direction. Goldie raised a hand.
Just shut your pie hole and listen to me one time. I don't like this any more than you do. It wasn't my idea. It was Kate's. She's a grown-up. I couldn't stop her if I wanted to. I prayed like hell your testimony would come in solid and none of this would be necessary. But now it is. We're out of good choices here.
I shook my head, fuming.
It gets us to the right result, he said. It's justice. You did good cop work. Every instinct you had was correct. So why should it end up that the scumbags walk free and two good cops get knives in their stomachs? How the fuck is that justice?
It wasn't my first time in court, and I understood the art of presenting information in a way that favored your side. But that was spin. That was the fight. This was literally making up evidence. This I had never done. As if reading my mind, Goldie said,
never in a million years would I have asked you to say this on the witness stand. Hell, I wouldn't have asked Kate either. She came to me with this. I tried to talk her out of it. You ever try talking Kate out of something?
I allowed for that. The pit bull was less stubborn than my partner.
And listen, At the end of the day, when my head hits the pillow and I try to put right and wrong on a scale and see which side's heavier, all in all, I think what she's doing gets us heavier on the right than the wrong. That's the best I can do, sport. I was still fuming, but there wasn't much I could do. I was done testifying. Nobody was going to ask me anything else under oath. It's not your decision. It's not mine, Goldie said. Let her do it, kiddo.
70. Judge Walter McCabe adjusted his eyeglasses and looked over a courtroom filled to bursting.
The court is prepared to rule, he said.
The hearing had lasted 3 days. My testimony took up the first day. Kate's filled the second day and part of the third, as defense lawyers poked and probed and came at Kate 10 different ways, trying to challenge her surprising revelation that she had followed 2 of the prostitutes home from the brownstone one night, gathered their information, and discovered their criminal rap sheets.
Why didn't you ever document that information? They asked. Why didn't you tell your partner, Detective Harney? Could it be that we're hearing this for the first time, suddenly, conveniently, after Detective Harney's testimony didn't go so well?
The courtroom was still. I heard the static ringing in the air that silence often produces. Or maybe that ringing was inside my head. The judge's ruling would determine the rest of my career.
The court finds that the search of the brownstone was valid, said the judge, reading from prepared text.
I released a long breath.
The detective surveillance gave them some reason to suspect that the brownstone was not a residence, but a brothel, a house of prostitution. More important, Detective Fenton's testimony that she surveilled 2 of the women working at the brownstone, ran background checks, and determined that they were prostitutes was credible, and it was sufficient to establish probable cause. On the night of the raid, the officers had probable cause to believe a crime was in progress, and they had reason to believe that, in the time it would have taken to secure a warrant, those men would have been gone, and the evidence of the crime, so to speak, would have been destroyed. The court finds probable cause, coupled with exigent circumstances. The defense motions to suppress is hereby denied. State?
Amy Lentini rose from her seat. State stands ready for trial, Your Honor.
Mr. DeCramer?
The judge asked the mayor's lawyer, who seemed to be the de facto leader of the defense team. Shaw DeCramer stood up. Could we put off the jury selection until tomorrow, Your Honor? The judge gave a slow nod. He understood. So did Amy. There wasn't going to be a trial. They took their shot on a legal technicality and lost. If they went to trial, 12 cops and 12 prostitutes, all of whom had been granted immunity for their testimony, would take the stand and publicly reveal every little detail of what happened that night behind closed bedroom doors. Kinky, humiliating details. The embarrassment far outweighed the minuscule chance for an acquittal. Every one of them would plead guilty. Already Shaw DeCramer had approached Amy, followed by other defense lawyers. They were lined up like customers outside a Toys R Us on Black Friday, hoping to get their hands on the newest version of the Xbox. The mayor will be pleading guilty, said DeCramer, keeping his voice low, though I was sitting in the front row of the courtroom, so I could hear him whisper to Amy. I'll draw up the papers, she said, shaking his hand. She might as well have called out, Next! It happened one after the other. All these lawyers who had drawn their knives and tried to slash me to bits, copying their pleas and hoping for mercy from the prosecutor on an agreed disposition. I looked behind me at Kate, who got to her feet and mouthed 2 words at me. You're welcome. I should have enjoyed this more. The eyes of the nation were on this courtroom, and we had won. Maybe the path we took was a little rocky, but I had told nothing but the truth, and Goldie was right. Justice prevailed. But I still had my briefcase at my feet, and it still contained an 8x10 photograph of Amy Lentini walking up the steps of the brownstone. I hadn't yet said a word to Amy, because all our focus had to be on this hearing. But now the hearing was over, and I felt something in the pit of my stomach, splashing and simmering. When the last of the lawyers had given his notice to Amy and the courtroom was otherwise empty, Amy looked at me, relieved, but not satisfied. I'd give anything to know how Kate's testimony came about, she said. I don't think you would, I said. Her eyebrows twitched. She swore to me it was true. I know she did. She swore under oath, too. When Kate first told Amy what she planned to say under oath, Amy didn't take it well. She pressed Kate over and over. She told Kate she would not suborn perjury. She would not let Kate testify falsely. But Kate never backed down. She swore it was the truth. They went back and forth like that for more than an hour, and Amy was clearly skeptical, but she didn't, and couldn't possibly, know that Kate was lying. Amy even pulled me aside and asked me if Kate was lying. But Kate, quite skillfully, had kept me out of it by saying that she never told me about her surveillance of those two women. So I didn't have to lie. I told Amy the truth. It sounded like bullshit to me. I was pretty sure she was lying. But I wasn't there. I'd gone home. I couldn't say for certain what Kate did or didn't do once I went home after the stakeout. Amy ultimately decided to accept Kate's testimony. She didn't really have a choice. From the look on her face, Amy had a pretty strong feeling that the card game she'd just won was played with a stacked deck. But she didn't know it for sure, and so she played the hand she was dealt. "Well," she said, warming up to her victory, letting it wash over her. "Should we celebrate?" I looked around the courtroom to ensure that we were alone. Then I reached into my briefcase, pulled out the manila envelope, and produced the glossy photo of Amy walking up the steps of the brownstone. I held it up for her to see. But when she reached for it, I drew it back. It was my only copy. Her expression dropped. Her posture stiffened. Where did I get this photo? It's hardly the most important question. Hell, it's not even in the top 10. Amy blinked hard and took a step back. Her eyes worked along the floor. But finally, after a long moment, while my heart drummed so hard in my throat that I doubted I could speak, Amy's eyes drifted up to mine. Her voice flat, her eyes hooded, she whispered to me, "Not here," she said. 71. I followed Amy from the criminal courts building at 26th and Cal to her condo in Wrigleyville. I played talk radio in my car as I drove. With our split-second news cycle, everyone was already talking about the outcome of the hearing. Mayor Francis Delaney had announced outside the courtroom that he would be resigning today. And just like that, they were already talking about who would succeed him. A number of aldermen and county commissioners were interested in running for the mayor's seat, but the presumed frontrunner would be Congressman John Tedesco. All because of my case. I should have felt adrenaline, some sense of power or awe, but instead I felt dread. We both found parking at the curb, went under the awning and through the downstairs door, took the elevator up to the 6th floor, and walked down the hallway to her apartment. All in silence, not a word spoken. We'd spent days, weeks preparing for a case that we had just won, but we looked like we were attending a funeral. It made me think of my friend Stuart, now freshly buried, reunited with his wife in heaven. What he used to say about reaching the point in life when you're sick of the bullshit and only want what's real. But I didn't feel that way. At that moment, as the two of us walked in grim silence to her apartment, I didn't want real. I wanted the fairy tale. I wanted what Amy and I were building together. At that moment, I wished I'd never seen that photograph of her outside the brownstone. I wanted to will it out of my brain, pretend I never saw it, and we would live happily ever after, cue the music and roll the credits. Amy entered the apartment and hung up her coat. She walked into the center of her living room and turned. Without any hint of remorse or embarrassment, she said to me, "I want to know where you got that photograph." "No," I said. "It's my turn to ask questions. I want to know what the hell is going on." Amy gestured toward my briefcase where I'd put the photograph. "That's a crime," she said. "Tell me about it. I think we just convicted a dozen people for it." Her eyebrows wrinkled. Forehead creased. "That's not what I'm talking about. You think..." "What? You think that photograph shows me about to have sex with a prostitute? Really?" I didn't have an answer. The truth was, I didn't have any idea what to make of this photograph. "I'm talking about obstruction," she said. "Whoever gave you that photo is guilty of obstruction of justice." It took a moment for that to sink in. What are you telling me? This was part of an investigation? Amy dropped her head, placed her hands on her hips, took a breath, made a decision. Billy, she said, raising her head. Did you ever wonder why I was so hell-bent on finding the little black book? From the first moment after the bust, when we hauled you and Kate into Margaret's office, all we cared about was the little black book. Did that ever strike you as odd?
It did, I answered. But I figured you were trying to smear us, to protect the mayor. Margaret Olson and Superintendent Driscoll, both of them had their jobs thanks to the mayor. They wanted to keep him in power so they'd stay in power.
She listened to all that and made a sour face, like those political shenanigans were beneath her. Then her expression broke and her eyebrows raised. Wow, she said. You must have had a really low opinion of me.
And she of me.
But we had gotten past that. We had sailed those treacherous waters and found something on the other side, something warm and soothing, something that made my heart go pitter-patter like a schoolboy kissing a girl for the first time. I couldn't deny it. I was all in. I was in love with Amy Lentini. Talk to me, I said. She nodded, took another breath, confirmed her decision. For the last year or so, she said, the state's attorney's office has been conducting an investigation. We have reason to believe that Chicago police officers have been running a protection racket, taking bribes to let people walk. I didn't move. Didn't show a thing. Didn't mention the fact that I had been investigating the same thing as an undercover officer for internal affairs. Two different law enforcement agencies investigating the same damn thing, not saying a word to each other. And this brownstone was front and center in our investigation, she said. Powerful people, with a place to go to get their jollies, indulge their fantasies, whatever. But it needs to be a safe place, right? They can't be caught publicly. The shame would be too intense. A woman like Ramona de Lavoux knows that. She's not going to draw the rich and famous to her club if they're afraid of a police raid, right?
Right, I managed.
Ramona de Lavoux was paying off cops. Protection money.
Who?
I asked.
What cops?
She looked at me, dead on, held perfectly still. Like a breathtaking portrait, my Italian beauty, my work of art. All that was missing was the gold frame and the artist's signature in the corner.
Who was Ramona paying off?
I tried again. The longer Amy paused, stood frozen, the harder my heart pumped. Kate, she said. Detective Catherine Fenton. 72. I felt a no reach my lips, but didn't say it.
Kate?
I mumbled. My brain tried to keep pace with my racing heart, tried to connect the dots.
Are you sure?
I can't prove it, if that's what you mean, she said. Process of elimination. It has to be her. I brought a hand to my face. The woman with whom I'd partnered, shared so much over the years. She was on the take? And I didn't know it? We were just about to find out, she said. We'd been tracking Ramona's bank accounts, her cash withdrawals. We were about to close in. I was literally in the process of drafting a complaint for a search warrant. We were no more than days away from raiding the brownstone. I slowly nodded. But then I raided the place first. But then you raided the place first. It was coming clearer now. You thought the cops knew, I said. You thought the dirty cops got wind of your investigation, so we raided the place for cover. Publicly exposed the VIPs. Got Ramona in the soup. Blew up the whole thing. And stole the little black book, she said. Right. Exactly. The little black book. The ledger. The computer disk. Whatever it was. Amy didn't want it for the names of the other VIPs who frequented the place. She didn't care about the identities of the Johns. She wanted the names of the cops Ramona de Lavoux was paying off. So you thought I was one of the dirty cops, I said. You thought I was part of the protection racket. I said it with a hint of accusation, though I couldn't blame her. As much as it burned, I couldn't deny that her initial reaction was logical. Before she knew me, it was her first instinct. She's about to raid the brothel and secure the little black book, and wham! I beat her to the punch by a matter of days.
and the little black book mysteriously disappears.
Yeah,
if I were in her shoes, I'd have suspected me too.
You are Kate, Amy said. You are the detectives in charge. So yeah, I suspected both of you for the protection racket, and stealing the little black book. But now I've ruled you out.
How? Why?
She was taken aback, hurt by the question. Because now I know you.
Too much. Overload. Too many emotions swirling in too many directions, blurring everything together. I needed to think straight, sort through everything.
Kate was the evidence recovery officer that night, Amy said. She would have had the easiest access to that black book. Easiest pie she could have pocketed it, and nobody would have known. I thought back to the night of the raid. Remembered Kate being so ginned up to go in. Remembered my thought that maybe we should call in Vice, because this was their turf, and Kate's reaction. Fuck Vice, this is ours. Remembered Kate leading the search upstairs of Ramona De La Vue's office. She easily could have done it.
Kate, I said again, only this time, not as a question.
That photograph you showed me, of me walking up to the brownstone, that just confirms what I thought, Amy said. That photo was taken only a couple of weeks before your raid. It had to be, because that was the only time I was there. I just wanted to see the place for myself. We'd spent so much time investigating it, but I'd never actually gone there. I didn't go in, I just walked up a couple of stairs and looked at it. She wagged a finger. But the photograph proves that somebody knew I was there.
Whoever snapped this photo knew that you, one of the top prosecutors with the state's attorney's office, was interested in that brownstone.
They knew we were close, Billy. The dirty cops knew we were coming. And then suddenly, just before we made our move, you and Kate lead a squad of officers and raid the place. And the little black book goes bye-bye.
She was right. It all lined up.
But Kate didn't act alone, said Amy. This operation is too big for one person. Which brings me to my original question when you first showed me that photograph. Where did you get it?
Found it on my doorstep, I said. Anonymous, plain manila envelope, no writing, nothing but the photograph inside.
She thought about that, disappointed that I didn't know more, paced her living room.
Whoever left me that photograph doesn't want me to trust you, I said.
Amy looked at me. Whoever left you that photograph is in on this with Kate.
I removed the photograph from my briefcase, examined it, turned it so Amy, who walked over to me, could look at it too. This is just like the others, I said. All the photos that Kim Beans has published. Same angle, same focus, same everything.
Same photographer every time, Amy murmured. We looked at each other. It registered with each of us at the same time. A cop's been feeding these photographs to Kim, Amy said.
I nodded. We find Kim's source, I said, and we find our dirty cop.
73. Hand to hand, I said to Amy. Kim's source wouldn't email the photos or text them. Too traceable. The U.S. mail wouldn't work. The photo could be damaged, and you can't control timing as much. He wouldn't FedEx it because he'd have to put down a credit card or walk into a store that has a security camera.
Amy thought about all that. She was a prosecutor, not a cop, but she'd worked some pretty big federal investigations, and she knew something about the cloak-and-dagger aspect of corruption.
And you don't think Kim already has all the photographs? She asked.
I shook my head. I don't think so. Whoever this dirty cop is, he's using Kim for some purpose, and he, or she, Amy added.
Right. The dirty cop, he or she, would want to maintain control over the situation.
Handing over all the photos at once to Kim is not maintaining control, it's giving all the leverage to Kim, letting her do whatever she wants with the photos whenever she wants.
Now, I continued, our dirty cop is smart. He'd want to keep Kim on a short leash. He'd want to hand her one photo a week, keep her nice and compliant and dependent on him.
Amy nodded, then looked up and squinted.
Well, Kim's next column comes out in 3 days. So if you want to catch her in the act of receiving a photo from her source,
I have to go right now, I finished. I have to start my surveillance right this minute.
I'll go with you, she said.
No, I work better alone.
Amy's mouth curled downward. Maybe Kate does too, she said. Maybe she's working alone on this. Maybe the person handing Kim those photos is the same person who stole the little black book. Kate. Or maybe Kate did neither of those things. Amy raised her eyebrows. I still haven't convinced you. It doesn't matter whether I'm convinced or not, I said. I'll find out when I shadow Kim. Speaking of which, you need to get going. Amy nodded. Promise me you'll be careful. People have been killed over this. Careful's my middle name, I said. I left. I didn't want to get drawn into a long goodbye with Amy, because knowing me and my lack of willpower, we would end up with our clothes off, and I really needed to hurry. I needed to know the truth. Was Kate really behind this? Was she shaking down Ramona de la Vue? Did she steal the little black book the night of the raid? Logic and reasoning made her the most likely suspect. But Kate? I got to my car and started it up. My cell phone buzzed. A text message from, well, speak of the devil. The message was from Kate. You never thanked me. When do I get my present? There was a photograph attached. It was a photo of Kate, a selfie, as they call it. She was lying in her bed, naked down to her bra and panties, an angle downward that maximized the cleavage shot, the come-hither look on her face, the hint of a devilish smile. Your basic male fantasy. Was this real? Or was this some kind of ploy to draw me in? I didn't know if Kate was trying to rekindle that brief, and in hindsight ill-considered, fling we had, or if she was playing me. Was she jealous or devious? Well, let's find out, Katie, I whispered. Let's see who delivers the photo to Kim. 74. My second full day of surveillance of Kim Beans. I spent yesterday following Kim to work, to a bar in Ukrainian Village, to the Whole Foods in Lincoln Park, and to a Bulls game last night, which took some effort, but I badged my way into United Center, one of the perks of the job. I saw no indication of any handoff, any passing of a photograph, or anything else. This morning, Kim arrived at her office in Dearborn Park at 8. No fancy downtown skyscraper. Chicago PC was just an online news outlet, so a medium-sized office with a plate-glass window sufficed. I had a thermos of hot coffee and a box of granola bars, ready to stay in one position for as long as it took. In the 90 minutes I'd sat on her office, I hadn't seen any cops enter or exit, but then I wouldn't expect them to. If you were an anonymous source, you wouldn't stroll into a newsroom. And nobody shuffling in and out of these doors since Kim arrived looked anything like a cop. Most of them were in their 20s and wore ponytails and nose rings and berets and headphones. The new age of journalism. My phone beeped. A text message from Kate. Another personal day for Billy? Are you sick or is it for fun? It was my second day in a row skipping work. I thought that Kate might take time off too after the big trial, but apparently not. It was yet another reminder of how far we had drifted, partners who once shared everything, now failing to even coordinate our work schedules. Just some personal stuff, I replied. You want some company? She came back almost immediately. I wanted to keep this informal, casual, but after the porn photo she sent me the night before last, it was hard to play dumb. I hadn't even acknowledged that photo, hadn't replied to her at all,